How to Make Great Radio. This was the week that Chris Moyles went back on commercial radio. He has been on commercial radio before, you know, on Chilton, and on, I put him on Capital Weekend Lates as well. So he's back on commercial radio, so quite a big week for him, obviously. It's the week that quarter four Rajar starts, and we're going to have a little chat about Rajar, perhaps, and audience, how to collect audience, and how Rajar works or doesn't work. Local, it's the week that a station that covers Camden Market went on air, which must be the smallest area in the country, has its own radio station. So localness, I suppose, will come into it. Regionalness, that's not a word, is
You've
it?
Invented national 10 words tonight so far.
And it's also the week that BBC Radio 4 announced they were going to make a series of programmes entitled Can Porn Be Ethical? So perhaps we'll just... No, I don't think we should discuss that.
Do you produce those?
No. I'd researched them, but not... No, I didn't. Don't say that. So let's start with the book, because it's probably the first book I've seen about actual practical techniques of radio. First question is why? Why did you write it?
I was amazed at... You must find this as well, Pete. Sometimes you have somebody who's been in radio quite a few years and you presume they know the basics, and then you get halfway through a conversation and you think, has no one ever told you that? You know, you say something like, you're off mic, and they say, what? And no one's ever told them that there's an end of the mic that you speak into, and there's a sound that changes when you move. And you think, has no one... So that's where it sort of started, annoyance at that, and some mistakes, some very simple mistakes made by people who really should know better. So it started with anger, like most things do, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So that's where it started. And then you realise that's only one chapter. So then you have to write a bit more. And the more I wrote, the more I wanted to find out. Because you know those things that are givens in radio? This is the radio rule. And you think, what? But why is it? So then I started digging and asking myself questions and finding out stuff myself along the way. So it turned out being a sort of how-to book, but not just for beginners. You know, for anybody any stage in their career. And it's not just about sort of how to do things, but also about, you know, keeping a job and what's audience research all about and all those questions that people often ask you and putting some flesh on the bones. And that's how it came about, really.
How long did it take to write?
Not long, because I cut and paste a few blogs to start off with, and then you're in the flow. And I finished it. I did 40,000 words, and I thought, yes, finished. And then I rang up the publisher and I said, finished. And he said, how many? I said, 40,000. He said, no, you need 70. So then we did a few more about what happens when the Queen dies and chapters like that.
Okay. Who do you think it's written for?
Well, it's written for anybody in radio, because I think I hope you found it interesting, Pete. It's just, it's got lots of stories in there as well, so it's not just textbook, it's lots of stories. It's the nearest thing I'll ever get to a biography, so hopefully it'll get a titter. And most people who've read it, no matter what they do in radio, said, you know, they found it quite enjoyable. And it's food for thought, because the thing about radio is there are very few wrong and right answers, and you can debate a lot, and I'm not saying that you will agree, as a fine programmer, Pete, you won't agree with every word in there, but at least you start to think about what you're doing, and if you're a broadcaster and you're thinking about what you're doing, that's a bloody good start, isn't it?
Yeah, most of it. I don't know if anyone's seen it yet, but it's available.
It's
now
from that table at the Princely, sum of £10.
£10 in the shop at £14.99.
Oh, yeah, so special offer tonight.
That's a considerable saving.
It is. Mitch can do a voiceover for us.
Can we have a voice? Thanks, Mitch.
Okay.
You haven't lost it. Okay, so I think what I thought was, before we go into some of the detail in it, is even if you've been in it, I mean, our combined radio age is probably about 187.
37 years for me.
But it fills all the gaps in a way. So you go, oh, yeah, actually. And it's all the little things that you haven't thought about for quite a long time. So I suspect it appeals to experienced broadcasters who might read it as a bit of a secret, in secret, because they know, you know, and students who would definitely find it useful.
Yeah, absolutely. And also you find that whatever your gig in radio, sometimes you have to do something a bit different, don't you? You know, whatever your station you're on and you've mastered that bit of radio, but then on occasions something happens, you have to do a charity auction, or you're doing commentary of a record-breaking activity for the breakfast show, and suddenly you need commentary skills. And you know, how many jocks can't do that? You know, give them something to describe. They've never done it. You know, football commentators, they're about the last bastion of really being able to, and this is your area, Pete, bring it home. But those skills, you know, a lot of jocks haven't ever had to do that. So when they have to do it now and again, you know, they need to call upon new skills. And I mentioned the Queen dying. But, you know, most shows, if something awful happens, not just a death like that, but whether it's 9/11 or whatever it is, sometimes you have to switch off the normal show and switch on something else. And the skill to be able to do that is another bucket of talent that some broadcasters will need to call upon now and again.
And it's great when, I mean, the biggest one was Diana, obviously. But when that happens, these events, and people do rise to it, it's great, isn't it? When you hear somebody coming out of their comfort zone, music jock suddenly has to stay on air for, you know, 6 hours.
And seeing it as an opportunity, as a bit, you know, great breakfast shows are dramas, aren't they? And they're usual happy-go-lucky dramas and tales of everyday life, and that's 99%. But on occasions, that bit of shade in a breakfast show makes your characters really real, doesn't it? And actually being able to master that and almost rubbing your hands together, sounds awful, but rubbing your hands together and thinking, here's an opportunity to make a very memorable show if I handle it right. And great broadcasters can do that.
So let's have a look at a bit of the detail. There's a chapter about getting into radio.
Yes.
And, you know, we all...
There's another one about getting out.
Well, I've managed that yet. But I don't know if, like me, I'm sure you're the same. We get endless, how do you get into radio? And part of me sort of says, if you're not trying, if you don't know, you know, how to hassle and get there, perhaps you shouldn't be in radio. I don't know. But how do you describe how to get into radio?
I wasn't going to put a paragraph in about that because I didn't want it to make it too basic. But then the publisher said, you know, it's a good thing. So we did the getting into radio thing. And the highlight of it was just remember how many different sorts of jobs there are in this business. Because, you know, you get loads of applications, don't you, for being a jock. And that's fine. God, we need, still need, and we'll always need great broadcasting talent. But there are loads of other jobs as well. I don't know about your recruitment, but when you advertise things like whether it's a commercial creative or a commercial programmer or a design creative or head of social media, all these other jobs, and you get a handful of applications. Mm. And you think, well, when you want to get into radio, ask yourself, are you really good enough? You know, it's tough to get in. It's even tougher to stay there. Are you going to be amongst the best at being a jock on air? And if you're not, are there other skills that you could put to better use? I mean, you know, great breakfast producers, how rare are great breakfast producers? I mean, there you've got to have someone who's got creativity and also is operationally sound, who can come up with the wacky ideas, but also says 8:20, you've got a live read, and you know, you need to do this bit quickly. So, and those, it's rare you get those two things in the same brain. And they've also got to be the best friend, and there's a whole chapter about producers. You know, the best friend, the shepherd, the motivator, the encourager for the talent, but also the guy who is acting in the program controller's interests and making sure it happens. So you've got to be the boss of the talent and the friend. That's an incredible job. And, you know, who sets out to be a breakfast show presenter? We need bright things to be breakfast show producers.
Yeah.
And they become the PDs of tomorrow, don't they?
They do.
So, you know, why aren't people going for those jobs? And commercial programmes, we had one guy who wrote to us about a year and a half ago, Tom, and he said, I want to be in commercial programming. And I've never had an email from somebody saying that. Because it's a great gig, isn't it? You can have some incredible fun working with great brands, creating great programming. It's a creative job where you just need some commercial awareness and the ability to, you know, sell it in. And, you know, he wrote, and because he wrote with a very unusual request, he got work experience the following week, a job about 3 weeks later, and he's now actually working for Global now, and he's on his second job, because he just decided that, you know, he decided on a less likely form for his career trajectory.
Another word you can't say. We're doing well. I agree with breakfast producers. I think is probably one of the hardest jobs, but one of the most rewarding, because you never get the glory either. That's the awful thing. The presenter naturally takes all the glory. If you're producing a talent, hopefully stations do appreciate breakfast producers when they do well. Yeah. They're always the guys that shout loudest at the... I still call them the Sony Awards or whatever awards, really. Where if the breakfast show wins an award, it's really the producer that should be up there.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Sam and Amy at our Gem station in the East Midlands doing very well. And, you know, they would readily admit after a drink that, you know, Paul Iliffe their producer works really hard for them, is part of their success, and is the one, of course, who put their reward entry together, because that's what they do as well, isn't it?
As a programme director, I obviously used to take all the credit myself.
I remember.
I found that was the best
way. I remember.
Oh, you did? you also write about how not only to get into the business, but how to stay in the business. And we do lose quite a lot of people. I don't know if that's the case at the BBC, but certainly people come into commercial radio and then find another job or go here or go there. And perhaps digital has slightly changed that, where people can move across different aspects of media now.
Yeah, it's clearly a fluid industry. But I think what I worry about is the number of great people who the industry loses for the wrong reasons. And that's partially because maybe they don't handle their careers as well as they should. And I mentioned in the book, quite a few people have come to me recently, 10, 15 years on, and pardon my French, said, "I was a twat, wasn't I?" And I say, "No, you weren't." I'm thinking, "You were." And you know, and because they were good,
tell them they are anyway.
Because they were good, you put up. You know, if they're good, you put up with a lot, don't you? And you help them through it. But at the end of the day, sometimes it's behaving like that that means their jobs, you know, the contracts don't get renewed, or they get seen as difficult, or they get swept aside. And I think just to realise that it's a very competitive field, and just bite your lip now and again, and realise that you may think your boss isn't particularly good, but you know, just counsel yourself and remember that actually there are other people around in the building who will observe your behaviour, who you know will also be in position of giving out work in the future, and just manage your own career carefully. And you know, people say, don't they? They hired me. They knew what I was. They should have expected it. Well, now they're asking me to do all that, and they go off on one. And you know, I get that. And clearly, if you're a program director wanting to buy a can of blue paint, you shouldn't buy a can of red paint. But if you do want, I'm not sure where this is going, but if it is a can of blue paint, the program director has every right to say, "I want it light blue there and a bit darker blue there, and I don't want any blue paint down here." You should expect that, because they're paying you. It's not voluntary work. So just a bit of two-way. But also in terms of keeping talent, I think management, that's us, Pete, should accept a responsibility for protecting the talent and sticking up for it, and realising that the best talent will on occasions do something wrong. And sometimes you defend them in public and you criticise them privately. Sometimes you criticise them privately and you in public you say, "They were wrong, this is what we've done," and being decisive about it. But helping them rather than just, you know, going into crisis mode when any broadcaster, surprise, surprise, on live radio, does something they shouldn't. And you know, the some famous examples, of course, at the BBC, where you just think, should that have been, or could that have been handled a little bit better? Because, you know, it will happen. It's not a surprise. And if you can't manage those situations as a manager, you shouldn't be managing.
Well, probably because I've you know, spent a lot of my time in London, agents figure a great deal there. And they do, you know, around the country as well, obviously, especially at breakfast shows. Have you dealt with a lot with agents and talent? And what's your view of how they manage things?
You will have done too. And some agents are great because they, you know, they've got two customers, haven't they? They've got their own customer and they've got you. And if you two can't agree and they can't get you two to agree, it doesn't work for anybody. And I've had agents who play the role beautifully and I think work in the interest of their talent and a good deal for us, and sometimes make our life easier in some of the difficult conversations. And there are others, and I remember one negotiation particularly where...
Who's this then?
I'm not going to say, but it was about a very, very well-known name, and the deal the agent was asking for was so ridiculous. It wasn't just high, it was laughable and out of all proportion to everything else, and there was absolutely no reason for it. And sort of you try and explain that gently to them, and then at the end of the day you have to say, I remember calling and saying, "Look, if you're playing tactics, they have to end now, because I am just about to pick up the phone and I'm going to actually hire somebody else, okay? So now's the time." And I did, and that was all fine. The talent, about a week later, "I wanted to stay here." "Well, you should have told your agent." You know, and being unreasonable and being dramatic about it and making a mountain out of it. You know, good agents, and there are quite a few around. I have to say some agents are exceptional at what they do, but there are others, and I'm not quite sure in whose interest they are operating. What do you think?
I agree. I think the interesting thing, take a legendary agent, Paul Vaughan, who looked after Chris Tarrant and Richard Allinson back in the day, and people like Larry Grayson as well. He was a big Midlands agent who looked after all the talent there. He was fantastic in the brevity of his... He only contacted us if it was the end of the line on an issue. And we only saw him really for lunch every 2 years when the contract... I mean, you know, we obviously wanted to keep Tarrant, so there wasn't a problem. But you could contact him and just say, you know, can Chris just move his holiday 1 week? It would really help. And he would help you. The issue was every 2 years, he used to take us to the old White House Hotel in London for lunch, which started at 11 in the morning. And you wouldn't discuss the talent until about 5 p.m., at which point, You were completely incognito. You had no idea what was going on anyway. So I think this was Paul Vaughan's trick to get you completely pissed so you agreed to anything. But to be honest, we agreed with anything with Tarrant anyway. So, but it was he was a beautiful agent. You know, he just had he knew not to disturb the equilibrium unless it was really important. And if he got involved, you knew it was a real issue as well. Whereas other agents I've dealt with are on the phone the whole time, you know, such and such isn't happy. I had a lady presenter who I won't mention who it was at Chrysalis Radio who locked herself in the toilet, and the agent rang me saying, she's not coming out until we've done, you know, and you go, what is going on? I can't go in the ladies, so I really need to, you know, I mean, there are ridiculous examples.
Yeah, we had a presenter who did something they shouldn't. And we had to read out an apology and a bit of legal to-ing and fro-ing, and we helped the presenter and paid legal fees and sorted everything out. We mopped up, as I think management should, we mopped it all up, and all they had to do was read out this sorry on air, and they didn't want to do it, which I sort of get, and the agent didn't want to do it. I thought, the agent should be telling them, get that read out. This company has supported you, you know, and I'm sure the talent would now agree with me that the agent should have pushed them to do that, because that would have helped their career.
Okay, you write a story in the book about... there's a nice story. It's story time. It's story time. There are some good anecdotes in here. It's not just... I mean, we're not just... You know, it's not just scientific analogy of the methods of radio. And there's some history there, because you're a bit of a historian.
Yeah,
and you're probably
absolutely
one of the country's radio historians, really. I mean, you collect stuff, don't you? And the story about the top 40, the start of the top 40 radio.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
Yeah, I love, you know, radio. You know, you can get portrayed as an old-fashioned anorak or somebody of today, and I quite happily am today. I'm incredibly excited about how radio is now and how it's changed, and this is probably the most important stage in the history of our medium since television in 1955, since, you know, the ITV coming on and the really emergence of television as a competitive force. I think this is the second, we're going to the third age of radio now. So it's fascinating looking back. And the story of Top 40 Radio, and if, you know, people ever ask you, you know, why do you play the same songs over and over again? You know, it dates back to that. And the story goes, it's back in, sort of going back to the 1930s, and what's happening is 1930s and 1940s into the beginning of 1950s, and what's happening is, of course, radio is giving way to television. So radio is thinking, American radio is thinking, what shall we do? It's no good doing quiz shows and drama anymore because people are going to television. What should radio do? And that was the big question. What should radio do? So this chap, this incredibly astute programmer, was sat in a pub and the jukebox was on, and he noticed that the same songs were coming round again and again and again, and he sat there and he made notes about it and went back and said, you know, that's the jukebox theory that generated the top 40 format that we have today. And it's a fascinating story, and it's a great way of explaining to people, especially listeners, when they write in, why do you play the same songs every again? You know, why you do it? You like that voice?
Well, we can't find any others.
Yeah. I've got a CD if you want to borrow it. We could.
I've sat through previous meetings with a variety of heads of music, and the most astute was Richard Parr, because he tended to have a sense of this record will really work, you know, and he used to he used to play around as well, you know, and put songs on to try them and burn them out deliberately, you know, put songs on. In the 90s, we were rotating 1 hour or 15, something like that, yeah. songs. So, you know, in drive time, you get the songs at least twice, if not three times. And, you know, we did all right.
Yeah.
So in different circumstances, it's a different game, obviously.
I remember one American consultant saying, the higher we rotate them, the more they moan and the higher the audiences go. But there we go. But we go back to old stories of old radio. Right at the beginning, I talk about Christopher Stone, who was, you know, the first jock. And but he was a handful, wasn't he? I'm the first jock. Yeah, and
did he have an agent?
Yeah, probably so. this was 1922, and he went to the BBC and he said, because they've got all live music and live bands and everything, and orchestras playing. And he said, look, I've got gramophone. I get all these gramophone records, and we don't have any shows to play them on. Why don't we have a show in which, instead of live bands, we actually play gramophone records? So it was his idea, and he went to the BBC with it, and the BBC said, we're not very keen on it. Turned him down. And then he came back again, persistent, and they said, OK, we'll give it a go. And they called this show, great show title this, they called the show Gramophone Records. And he played gramophone records. But when you listen to what he did, and there are some great recordings of Christopher Stone, the way he communicated was just inspired, because it was the best conversational, friendly, one-to-one radio that we know great communicators now do. And there's one bit that he says, sir, I know you'd like to hear more of that, and so would I. You think that's amazing. In an area which was so formal, to realise, I mean, it was very one-to-one, because he probably only had one listener in 1922. It's like my hospital radio station. But you know, the way that he communicated, it's a real art.
And there's a whole chapter, I think, on the you...
There is. Yeah, I'm obsessed with this, because I can't bear it. I mean, isn't it lesson one, day one in radio, that there's one listener listening, and talk to them and you don't go far wrong? Isn't it? And yet you hear national names, don't you? Any of you out there? Where? Out where? Who? And last night I heard somebody say, I was sitting on my own in the car, and all I could see was a bus and a few more cars, and they said, help you make your minds up. Help me make my mind up. I've only got one. And it just feels wrong. And we know statistically, don't we, from radio, and we believe radio, that you know most radio consumption is actually alone. And I would argue as well that even when you're not alone, your dialogue with the radio station is one-to-one, because you hear a song and your emotional dialogue with that song is different from mine. So you know, it's always one-to-one, really. And, you know, those phrases really work. And, you know, when you hear it in its most complex form, when you've got, say you're doing a BBC local breakfast show, and you've got guests, and you've got ISDN contributors, and you've got listeners, and you've got the person from INRIX, and you've got lots of people. And at any one stage, any of those people can be you, can't they? So have you got any update on the M69 problem? And then to the caller, when did this happen? And then back to the listener. And you can hear presenters wrestling with this. And you hear a presenter interviewing someone, and at the end they'll say things like, "And where can listeners get a copy of the book from?" I'm thinking, listen, why are you referring to me as if I'm somebody over here that doesn't matter? And all you've got to do, and I also told Jocks, you imagine there's one chair in front of you, and different people sit in it, and it just keeps on changing. So you've got the caller becomes you, and then they move, and then you change, and the listener becomes you again, and it feels natural. People get that, because in conversation it's what you do. You I say you, and I look at you, Mitch, and I turn to you, Pete, and you, and the you changes, and it's really easy. But it sounds so odd, doesn't it? And I draw parallels with blooming rail announcers. You know, passengers are invited. What? I mean, as opposed to dogs and cats, you know, and all this bloody language about vestibules and beverages and all that rubbish. You know, the words are so important. And some presenters just look at me a bit odd when I keep on going on about the power of words, but it's all we've got. You know, I can listen to your radio stations, Pete. I can go on Radio Monitor. I can get all the songs in the right order, and now we've got the same Ofcom format. I can play them in identical order tomorrow. I can replicate your radio station. The difference between us is what your presenters say and what my presenters say. So it's all you have, the bullets you fire, and therefore choosing the vocabulary and the way that you frame things is about winning or losing. And talk to a comedian about the the pain that goes into choosing particular words and why things are funny and why a Tesco carrier bag is funnier than a carrier bag and why it blow the bloody doors off is remembered because it's got the word bloody in it. Just put profanities in every sentence, that works. But, you know, all these ways of using words, but 70% is sort of fader up. Right the way through to 12. I mean, why are your first words telling me when your show ends? I mean, where is the sense in that?
Who cares?
Do they not think what they are saying? That is just like coming out without saying, you are painting a picture. That is what we're expecting you to do as a broadcaster. I was watching the, you know, it's the ITV's 60th the other day, and I watched back the opening sequence, and it's a black and white, as you'd expect, black and white aerial shots of London. You've got St Paul's, everything else, and there's this wonderful stentorian voiceover which Mitch Goodell, I asked him, because that's how they used to speak, and it was September the 22nd, 1955, another sentence in the story of London. I think, oh, that's gorgeous, isn't it? And why was it gorgeous? Because they weren't very good at telly. They were still doing radio, actually. So they were thinking about the words. I mean, now, continuity on BBC telly. I mean, it's a £5.99 mic from Tandy, and they haven't put the music down. I mean, it's awful. There is no thought as to the words. And, you know, if we heard that now, it would be some awful regional TV announcer, not only saying, a new television station has opened today, what they'd read it in that awful voice where they go, a new television station has opened today. Why do they? So words and delivery, they're important. And
we'll come on to news reading as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I think, you know, you see people in the early days of radio sort of cuddled around the radio listening as a family, you know, but that changed very quickly when television arrived, because television became the family entertainment.
Yeah.
Do you think the we'll get on to a subject? I mean, we're both commercial animals, obviously. But this is a subject that affects BBC as well, I suspect, and that's the whole network, regional, local, community. Where are we now, do you think? Where is the state of radio, and who's winning and losing in that sort of part network, part local? I mean, you're with a group that runs radio stations, but you've hubbed them together to a certain extent, but you keep them separate in terms of...
It's fascinating, online, isn't it? Because everything goes full circle, isn't it? Plus ça change, plus la même chose. In the beginning, radio was local, BBC radio was local, wasn't it? And then they joined together and thought, we can have regional transmitters, and 5XX replaced 5NG and 2LO and everything. So it went regional, and then then we had just national, and then BBC local again, and commercial radio starting very locally. But it wasn't, you know, the commercial radio network was not assembled particularly well, was it? I mean, they had 19 stations.
Haphazard.
And the reason they had 19 was they were going to have more, but they changed government and the 60 became 19. So they weren't plotted around very well. And as a business, you didn't cover the whole country. So if you were Birdseye, you couldn't advertise to the whole country. So, you know, it was very difficult. And, you know, there are those who say, oh, I think it's absolutely disgusting that Powers closed down and Oceans closed down, and it used to be Radio Victory and it was local and everything was wonderful. But there is such a thing as rose-tinted spectacles. I mean, I love the history of radio, and we should remember it and document it. But actually, it probably wasn't all as good as we thought it was. And anybody who's played back C90s from years gone by of commercial radio stations, you hear songs you don't know, links from presenters going on far too long about very little. And the science, I mean, now after breakfast shows, we sit down there, we worked out what went well this morning, what didn't go so well, what we do better tomorrow, where's this storyline going? I don't remember any of those conversations in the 80s. The science that goes into radio now is so much more, and the same is true for BBC stations and national stations. So I guess what I'm saying is that the commercial radio industry started piecemeal for no good reason, and if there was to be a future for commercial radio, we have to have powerful national brands, and if they have to be assembled very painfully and unfortunately by closing down existing radio stations and you know, changing the brands, I'm sorry, there is no alternative. The great thing is now there is a tier of other media now, community radio, and actually, you know, access to platforms is now easier than ever. You can stream your own radio station if you want. You can get stuff on YouTube and Audioboo and SoundCloud. It's actually very easy to create content and cheaply to create content and carriage and platform. So there are other ways of getting things from A to B. And I think that mixed ecology is where it's at. As far as localness is concerned, I hate the word localness because you just think of lost dogs, don't you, when you think of local. So we always used to use the word belonging, and that sort of said, there isn't a brick wall round our county, so it's not to say that if it's outside our county boundary, we're not interested. We just accept that our listeners live round here, therefore their friends probably do, and they grew up round here, and they have a particular sphere of influence, and they have chosen to live here. They could have lived somewhere else, so they've got an affinity with it. They like being round here. And reflecting that, I think, in a radio station is a powerful card to play. I don't think it is the biggest audience driver. There are those who say, if you say, we are the local station, you will be number one, because that's what everybody wants. Well, everybody might say that's what they want, but if you look at audience figures, the local stations, you know, in fairness, BBC local stations do the very best, I think, at being local to their communities. They will be number one in every market if being local was the biggest audience driver, whereas actually it's about, I put the radio on to cheer me up, and then probably to arm me with the things I need to know. So it's the news and information and the localness is extremely valuable, but it's probably not the audience driver. And also locals, it's not just about local news, is it? It's about a perspective, a spirit, an understanding, a relatability. It's about when a caller comes on, she says she's from so-and-so, so-and-so, and you say, is that down the road from so-and-so? And if they close down that so-and-so, suddenly there's that connection. And it's like, you know, and mentioning local place names is extremely important. When you're on holiday and you're walking down the Rambla in Barcelona and all these hubbub of accents and you hear somebody say Southampton, you will hear that. Well, you will hear that, apart from your own name, it's just when you hear your own name in a conversation, apart from your own name, that is the one word which is, it's in neon lights in your life. It's incredibly important. So belonging, I think, has a powerful role to play, but I'm not sure that just being local is the answer to success. That's a very long, waffly answer.
It's very good.
Is it?
Yeah. I'll give you a pricey afterwards.
Well, thank you.
In terms of BBC, I mean, we know, you know, initially the BBC got all of the national licences. And I do think, and we might discuss BBC local radio, which I think is really interesting, especially from this building, after a person we know, John Myers, who wrote a report which was widely admired and then probably widely ignored, but an interesting report in itself. Where do you think the BBC goes now? Because they obviously have issues with licence fee, but below that, they're running some fantastic national products and some great local radio stations, but they're quite big regional stations now. How do you think all that fits into the radio landscape now?
Yeah, I absolutely worship the BBC, and you know there are those in commercial radio who, you know, just slag it off. Say, I think it's just, you know, I would campaign naked for Radio 4, and I think it's the most delightful radio station in the world. Yeah. And there are some bits I hear, some beautifully crafted bits. I am in tears. I think this radio is so good. So the BBC is excellent without it, and we must make damn sure that when we're through all this current, you know, we end up keeping the right bits and spending less money on all the bits we don't need to. And every single person in the BBC, everybody I speak to the BBC speaks a lot of common sense and comes out with 100 stories about things that would make this thing so much simpler, so much better, and so much cheaper and easier to run. But we've got to make sure the right things are sacrificed, not the wrong things. So as far as the future is concerned, I can't imagine that radios 1 and 2 will be privatised. I mean, that's been around for, ever since I've been in radio, they've been talking about that. And I'm not sure.
Why not, do you think?
Well, it would probably, and this was the original argument against it, it would probably, I think, decimate the revenues of
it would take
everybody else. It would completely skew the ecology of everything. And you know, the Radio 1 and 2 are where they are for a particular set of reasons. So I'm not sure that is the future. But you know, it's great that Radio 1 and Radio 2 will be pushed to be more distinctive, but sensibly so. And I'm not one of these people on the commercial side who think they should be, you know, just broadcasting really dull programmes. You know, they've got to do enough that is distinctive, and then hats off to them. If they can keep people, particularly 15 to 24s, interested in radio, that's a victory for us all. So good luck to them. As far as local radio, Radio 4, please leave alone, preserved in aspic, apart from Front Row, which I hate that programme. hate, oh, I can't stand
Radio 5
I hated, I was so pleased when they got rid of Kaleidoscope, then they bring something back that's just the same. Anyway, so that's Radio 4. Radio 3 I'm not quite sure about.
Well, you say, that, yeah, that's an interesting thing, Radio 3, though, isn't it? Because it's the one station that's had a commercial,
a competitive national station up against it.
Mm. It. I know it's different, and I know it's serving a cultural purpose. But does it serve that purpose, do you think, in terms of audience?
It's,
I mean, there are people who say it should have a bigger audience, but I don't know.
It just needs to stay distinctive, doesn't it? And not following the classic, I mean, inspired operation, I think. And they did it as a sort of normal radio station with conversational people playing classic tunes. It's a brilliant format. And let Radio 3 do what it does. Right. And the investment of Radio 3 into the orchestras and live music and stuff is brilliant. Local radio, I think they should stay being local. And I think that it is a shame when... thing, and no offence to Mark Forrest, because he's a great guy and I think his show's good, but I really think they should stay at being local. I was pleased that we didn't have the regionalised afternoon show, and listeners don't live in regions, really. I mean, I live in Nottingham. I don't know what the East Midlands is. I don't know where it goes. I've got as much interest in Leicester as I have in Southampton. So listeners live in their own communities. They define their own communities, and their radio stations should broadcast to their own communities. And it's all very well saying, well, we need to make a few economies. But I would say, if you gave the skilled managing editors the budget and said, look, the budget's slightly down, here it is, you spend it wisely. You spend it wisely to produce the best possible radio station you can possibly manufacture for 50 plus of whatever the target audience is, and you do it your way. When you want to buy in resources from the BBC, here's the cost. If you want to get it somewhere cheaper and you don't want the official window cleaner that costs five times more via BBC, all these weird and wonderful systems the BBC has, just run your radio station for the people in your area the best you possibly can. We would have a great tier of radio stations, and they would employ great journalists who love the area, and they would employ fine communicators who actually get it, and also stay there as well. Because one of the great things about BBC local radio is people use it and come through and get experience. But the throughput of people means that they're often, maybe they don't understand the area as well, because they're taken off on attachment somewhere, and somebody, it all becomes very complicated. And does it lose sight of what the typical BBC local radio listener really wants, expects and pays for from her BBC local station? I'm trying to look at whether I'm getting scowls or whatever from the other side of the room here.
No, well, and we will take some questions. I think two things, definitely. BBC has kept the standard of commercial radio up. I think that's without doubt.
Yes.
And secondly, the biggest compliment paid really is that global radio want to create national networks to compete with the BBC.
And absolutely.
I think, why not? Why not? Because that's the standard set. Why shouldn't global radio try and beat it? It was one of the greatest things when I was running Magic in London, which did okay, but it was always... The great result was when our reach beat Radio 2 in London, because that really was the benchmark, especially in London. Radio 4 was out of sight. But if we beat Radio 2, we really did get the champagne out. I mean, obviously beating commercial competitors was great. That really was the benchmark.
And hats off to Global, because I loved the early days of commercial radio, and Radio Trent has we all love our first station, don't we? Radio Trent for me was something that just I've got such fond memories of, and I touched the when I used to go on air on Radio Nottingham for a short period, and I used to pass it, I used to touch the doorknob for good luck of Trent on the way, because it's just having said that, I think that the investment, the passion, the ambition, the professionalism of Global is something that this industry would be much poorer without.
Yes. On that note, I can only agree, obviously, playing the party line. Do you want to take a short break? Are there any questions on so far, or are we covering
stuff? Looking forward to talking to you.
I think I better get a drink. Why don't we get a sandwich and a quick drink and reconvene? Thank you, David.
Thank you.
And
thank you, Pete.
It's worth a read.